We are in session two of parables. And I said that a parable comes from para, balo, beside para, balo, to throw. You throw something beside something else to explain it. That's why the word where parable came from. The first 2 years of Jesus' ministry, he taught in typical rabbi fashion, which would have been conceptual, didactic, logical arguments. That's how Jesus taught. However, the leadership, those who called themselves, Jesus said, you sit on Moses' seat, to his enemies. These are the people who ran Israel. And he said, they decided we're rejecting you. You're not only not the Messiah, you're Beelzebub, you know, so Lord of the Flies. You're of the devil. In fact, they said, you're a Samaritan and have a demon. You know, that was the rejection. That occurred in Matthew chapter 12. From that moment on, Jesus said, I'm not going to teach the same way I've taught in the past. I'm going to teach a lot now in parable fashion. And that's the last year of his ministry is when Jesus taught in parables. And so consequently, it wasn't like he did that all the time. He said to the disciples, I teach in parables so that you'll understand and they won't. Now, it's just kind of an interesting thing because when you read the accounts in the Gospels, the disciples are often saying, would you explain that parable to us? We're not sure we understand. In fact, one time when I was reading this week, he said to them, do you understand? And I think they all said, yeah, we got it. We understand. I don't know if they did or not. There's no way of knowing that. So the idea of the parables, almost all the parables, about 40 in the Gospels, right around 40, almost all of them are in Matthew and Luke. And they're all in the Synoptic Gospels. John doesn't deal in parables in his Gospel. So as of last time, now I want to go to chapter 13 of Matthew, chapter 13, because these parables are used to inaugurate a completely different perspective of the ministry of Jesus Christ. When Jesus Christ presented himself to the nation Israel, he presented himself as their Messiah. You see, I am the Messiah. Not just the Son of God, not just the Savior. I am now Israel's Messiah. Israel now has formally rejected Jesus Christ as the Messiah. So consequently, then, the program is now changing. That's the whole point. Jesus is changing everything now. I'll give you a good example. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus takes 70 and he sends them out, okay, to witness. He sends them out and he basically says to them, you're to only go to the lost, you only go to the villages in Israel. You don't go to Samaritans and you don't go to Gentiles at all. Do not go to them. And this has nothing to do with either group. You get to the end of the Matthew and he basically tells them what in the Great Commission? Go and make disciples by going. You go over the whole world now. You take the gospel to everybody now. The Gentiles are now included in what is now called a new thing that the Apostle Paul said was a mystery that God revealed to him to explain so everyone would understand it. And that mystery is the church. Okay, that's the new mystery that is fulfilled. In other words, something that God had decided that the program had changed, Paul now explains the mystery is the church. And he explained it this way, Jews and Gentiles now, in a sense, grafted together into one body of Christ. That's a whole different thing. No one understood that. The other disciples had no understanding of this, none. They're Jewish through and through. They could not understand this. That's why, by the way, when you're reading through the book of Acts, remember someone like Peter. Whenever Jewish believers from Jerusalem came, guess what Peter would do? He wouldn't eat with Gentiles. Believing Gentiles, I won't eat with them. They're dirty. They're unclean. I can't touch them. And Paul's like, what are you doing? In fact, Paul says that. In Galatians, he said, I took Peter in front of the church in Antioch, and I rebuked him in front of everybody because of what he did. They had a lot of trouble with this. Paul says it's because they didn't understand the mystery until I came. So, in Matthew, for example, I use little ways to remember things, but in Matthew, this is the way I've always done it, but it's an easy way for me to remember. Chapter 1, where the king came from. Chapter 2, the baby grew. Chapter 3, the father's pleased. Chapter 4, temptation store. 5, 6, and 7, a sermon from heaven. 8 and 9 is power divine. Chapter 10, to Israel send. Chapter 11, Israel's leaven. Chapter 12, the kingdom is shelved. 13, 14, 15, the program is now changing. You see, now you got that, it'll be on the exam tomorrow, you know. All right, now, so here we are in 13. And notice, this is very much immediate. On that day, Jesus went out of the house and was sitting by the sea. And great multitudes gathered to him, so that he got into the boat and sat down, and the whole multitude was standing on the beach. Jewish rabbis teach by sitting. So Jesus has still got that. He sits down in a boat, and then you sort of have an amphitheater effect of people. And they all want to hear now what he is saying. So it says, he spoke many things to them in parables. You see, now he starts. And this is a really interesting thing. So we're going to start with the very first parable. He says, behold, the sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seeds fell beside the road, and the birds came and ate them up. Others fell upon rocky places where they did not have much soil. And immediately they sprang up because they had no depth of soil. But when the sun had risen, they were scorched because they had no root, and they withered away. And others fell upon the thorns, and the thorns came up and choked them out. And others fell on the good soil, and it yielded crops, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. And then he says a favorite phrase, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. And I imagine for the Jews the first time, what? What did he say? This is the first parable. This is the parable, in a sense, of the sower. Now, the important thing when you understand or try to interpret something that's a parable or parabolic is a parable is designed to teach one core central truth. It's not like Paul writing Romans 5 and says, look, you can learn all these things if you read Romans 5. Parables aren't like that. It's got a very singular piece of advice of what it wants to teach. So, let me give you some background on this idea. This would be something that everybody there would understand. The sowing of the seed is the staple of Israel. They know how this works. And from that point of view, the sowing of the seed is very, what you'd call a common image for the nation Israel. And there's no fences in Israel. There's no fences. There's no property line like that. There aren't any. That's not the way this works. What ends up happening in this case is that every piece of property that is owned by an owner has a path around it. The path is free for everybody to walk on. You can walk on those paths. Now, if 100 people walk on that property line, what becomes to the path? It becomes like concrete. All right? Now, there's no plowing beforehand. This is not a plowing scenario. This is where a sower comes and he takes handfuls of seed and he just throws them. They make sure they don't put them in piles, they throw them. After they've thrown the seed virtually almost everywhere, then someone comes with almost like a rake tool and then sort of rakes the soil to allow some of the seed to get in and be able to germinate. And so these are the images that Jesus is going to use here. And so consequently, they call that sowing method the broadcasting method, and that's exactly what it is. Now, the seed here for Israel would have been clear. It's wheat. That's the staple for them. That's their eating staple. And so some of the seed landed on the walking path. And so that's why Jesus says after he says that, notice he said, And he sowed, and some of the seeds fell beside the road. That's on the walking path. The birds came and they ate them up. Because of, there's no dirt around him or anything. It's just, oh, that seed, I'm going to eat that. He's done with that. Then, after he does that, which is very common, he talks about these types of soil. The first one, as I said, is roadside soil. The second one is kind of interesting, and we probably misunderstand it. He said, and as he sowed, some seeds fell beside the road, and the birds came and ate it up. The others fell in rocky places where they did not have much soil, and immediately they sprang up because they had no depth of soil. This is not rocky places like you'd think. This doesn't mean, oh, they had a whole bunch of rocks in there, some big rocks. They didn't have it, no. They farmed these lots for hundreds of years. They get the rocks out. This has to do with what's under the soil. A lot of places in Israel, maybe a short distance, maybe 6 inches, maybe is limestone. It's called rocky soil. There's limestone. So what happens is you drop a seed in, and that seed, because of moisture that would fall, will germinate faster than anybody else's seed. So if you looked at it first, in fact, you can read accounts of it where people at that time in that part of the world, the farmer become very skeptical if he saw his plants turning green too fast. He's like, that's not right. You see, why? The water is trapped, in a sense, by the limestone, so they set like in a little bit of very moist soil. So they blossomed really fast. But they never put down roots. There's no roots. Can't go through the limestone. So he ends up saying here, in that context, he says, they fell upon the rocky places. They didn't have much soil. Immediately they sprang up because they had no depth. But when the sun had risen, they were scorched because they had no root. They withered away. That's the second soil. The third soil. Others fell among the thorns, and the thorns came up, and they choked them out. Now, it's a thorn, but not the way I think you and I think about thorns. This Greek word is acantha. Acantha is the same word that was used for Jesus' crown. Same type of thing. But again, Hollywood will tell you it's got these big thorns. You've seen the movies, you know, that's the thorns he had on. Now, that wasn't what he had on. The acantha plant is in that part of the Mediterranean. It's a shrub, and it has very spiny, prickly type of leaves. It's thorns, but it's different. It's common in that part of the world. And so consequently, notice what he says, it fell among the thorns came up, and it choked them out. And there's a principle here ever since Genesis 3, after Adam and Eve sinned and the curse that came upon them. And I don't know if you've ever noticed this. This would be worth coming tonight to hear this because you may have never known it. Weeds grow faster than anything else. Profound, isn't it? I mean, weeds really grow. And that's the point. You see, the points are the weeds just grew and choked it out, took all the moisture, and they didn't. So now we get to the last one. And others fell on good soil, and they yielded crops 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. Now that's pretty amazing. I want to give you an imagery of this why the Jews would understand. I want you to hold your place here. Go with me to Genesis 26. Genesis chapter 26. We'll look at verse 1, then we'll go to verse 12. Genesis 26:1 of Genesis. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar, and he said to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. Isaac decides he's got to go. There's a famine in the land. He didn't go to Egypt. Remember, that's what ended up happening when Joseph was in Egypt. He goes to the Philistines because of the famine in Israel. Now, what's interesting about that is, notice verse 12 then. Now, Isaac sowed in that land, in Philistine. He said, and he reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed them. That's verse 12. He reaped in the same year fold, and the Lord blessed them. Let me tell you how unusual that is. A great crop in Israel at the time was tenfold. If you had a great crop, you had tenfold. Notice, but Isaac got 100-fold in the land of the Philistines because of God blessing him. And so back to Matthew, that's what Jesus says. Notice, others fell in good soil and yielded crops, some 100-fold, some 60, and some of them 30. That no matter how you cut it, that's a really excellent crop. Now, I want you to understand some things here. First of all, nothing is said about the skill of the sower. There's no words about that at all. Nothing is said about the quality of the seed. This is all about what? The soil. That's what the parable is about. The soil. Not the skill of the sower, not the quality of the seed. It's the sower. So what ends up happening after that is said, his disciples came to him and said, why do you speak to them in parables? This is new to the disciples. Why are we talking in parables here? And he answered and he said to them, to you it has been granted to know the mysteries, same word Paul used about the church, to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it's not been granted. I don't want them knowing. Their leaders, they'll notice, they have rejected him in full. For whoever has, to him shall more be given. He shall have an abundance, but whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing they do not see, while hearing they do not hear, and they do not understand. And in the case of the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled now. You will keep on hearing, you will not understand, you will keep on seeing, but you will not perceive. For he says, the heart of this people has become dull. And he said, their ears, they scarcely hear, and they have closed their eyes. Lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return, and I should heal them. Now, here's what he meant by that. Now we know what the soils represent. It's in there, what I just read. It's their heart. You see, that's exactly what he said. It's an interesting thing, verse 15, for the heart of this people become dull. All these kind of people are represented here. Now notice then what he says to them. He said, but blessed are your eyes because they see and your ears because they hear. Truly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it and hear what you hear, but they did not hear it. He says, now, let me explain the parable of the sower to them. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes, snatches away what has been sown in his heart. He said, this is the one whom the seed has sown on the beside the road. There are sometimes, and by the way, you can take this is the kingdom and this is for Israel, I get that, but it's true of the gospel in the same way. The application would even be the gospel. You can give the gospel to somebody, and there's absolutely zero response. None. He said, yeah, not the birds, but the evil one. Yeah, how does a heart become so hard? Well, there's a lot of ways to do it. And by the way, Satan knows them all. That's the whole point. Can someone reject the truth based on an intellectual argument? Sure. Sure, you just reject it. I think I understand this. Satan's ace in the hole, though, the greatest tool he ever used to fulfill that part of the parable, religion. You talk about hard soil, try to talk to someone who's extremely religious. Religious people do not want to hear this at all. Not at all. I don't want to hear anything about this. You see, religion is man's way to get God to accept him through a man's own whatever form of works it would be. A religious person is a very, and by the way, at the time of Jesus, who were the most religious people in Israel? Pharisees. And how'd they warm up to Jesus? And that's Jesus. That's the Son of God. Nothing. They had nothing but hostility for him. That's why Jesus said to them, what? You are of your father. What? The devil. See, Jesus knows who they are. He understands what happened, and this is his interpretation. He said, then he said, and the one whom seed was sown on the rocky places, this is the man who hears the word, immediately receives it with joy. That's great. That's really wonderful. Yet, he has no firm root in himself. It is only temporary, and when affliction and persecution arises because of the word, immediately he falls away. Okay, you're going to see where this interpretive problem becomes a problem in just a moment. That's the second group. Third group. And the one to whom the seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke out the word and it becomes unfruitful. Misplaced priorities. God didn't want to mess with my life. I want to be a success. I don't want to hear this. And it all chokes out. Then, and the one on whom the seed is sown, on good soil, this is the man who hears the word, understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. That's the good soil. Now, the debate through Christianity for since the Reformation anyway, which of these four groups are saved? Okay, everyone agrees what group is saved? Four, right? And then there's just nothing but fierce debate about two and three. You see what I mean? You can see how this works. Well, there's the completely unsaved, and then there's the people that might be saved. Do you think that's what Jesus is teaching now? Now, he's teaching a parable. He's teaching about four completely different responses. Now, remember, this is the first parable. The disciples are wondering why you're even teaching a parable. That is a pretty sophisticated argument to take all four of these in a parable and make them something completely different. Now, just reading this week, I read good men who said three and four are saved, and good men that said two, three, and four are saved, many good men that said four only saved. But is that exactly what Jesus is doing here? Is that exactly what he's trying to explain here? And I think that becomes a very difficult thing to ascertain. You see, but what Jesus is saying is, my words are received in very much different ways. And I'll give you an example of this. Let's just take the group two or three, either group. You go into John 6, and you're reading in John 6, and it says, many of his followers, Jesus basically says in John 6, you have to take all of me or none of me. There's nothing in between. That's when he made the metaphor. You have to eat my body, drink my blood. It's got to be me, totally me. It said then in John 6, and many of his disciples walked with him no longer. We're done. Now, if you read it in John 6, when you read in John 6, you say, well, they were all saved. Would you say that? Not likely. You see, you'd not likely say it. No, they were listening to Jesus, and they loved what they saw Jesus do. But when Jesus basically said, it's all of me or none of me, I'm not so sure I can go for that. You see it? And so I think what Jesus is basically saying here is that the news of the kingdom of heaven or the gospel of Jesus Christ by application falls on different kinds of hearts. You see, there's different kinds of hearts of how people receive this. And so consequently, I am very convinced that group one never had a chance, and group four are clearly believers. Two and three, I'm agnostic. I'm not sure. You see, because I'm not even sure that's what Jesus' aim was with this, because he's going to build all these things. What he's really going to try to do here in Matthew 13, and you have to understand this because it's such an important thing to understand, is this. Jesus is now trying to teach things to his disciples. He wants them to understand, because you have to understand what their frame of mind is. How many times do you see in the Gospels, he said, I must go to Jerusalem, I must suffer at the hands of men, they're going to abuse me, arrest me, crucify me. And how the disciples take that? They didn't. Well, what's the will of God? He told them that for a year and a half. I'm going. No, you can't go. Why? It doesn't compute to them. You're the Messiah. You're not only the Son of God, you're the Messiah. Messiah is going to lead the nation Israel. How could you do that if you're killed? You see, they really struggled with this. Now, Jesus wants to explain how this whole program is about to change. So he's preaching in parables. And I believe each one of these parables speaks specifically to them in certain ways, as we'll continue as we move on here. So, then after that, we'll find ourselves. There's one other way of looking at that that parable too. He may be saying this to his disciples in that parable. William Barclay was a guy who had said this, that no matter how much seed may seem to be wasted, rejected, in the end, a great harvest is to come. And that would make sense to the disciples. And by the way, is that consistent with Scripture? What did Jesus say, broad and narrow? Did he ever use words like that? And that was in the context of Israel. Broad is the way that leads to destruction. Who finds it? Many. Narrow is the gate that leads to life. Who finds it? A few. Well, that speaks to, see, that aligns with this parable as well. It's all, so in that sense, there's some truth to that, the way that he relates to the disciples. Now, notice the next parable that he goes to, the wheat and the tares. He presented another parable and said to them, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. Okay, we're right back to the same thing again. But while men were sleeping, his enemy came in and sowed tares also among the wheat and went away. Now, in this parable, you have the good seed of the kingdom, and it's being sown, the truth, and the enemy comes in and he sows too. And what he sows is tares. Now, in the early stages of the development, tares and wheat look the same. They do. That's the point. Wheat and tares. Tares and wheat. They look the same. So he goes on and he says, but when the wheat sprang up, it bore grain. And then the tares became evident also. Not until that grain pot on the top of the wheat is there do you know that's wheat and that's not. You see, you've heard this all the time. The wheat and the tares. The wheat and the tares. If you're looking for an application of it, is everybody who attends church in the world saved? Pretty skeptical, aren't we? In fact, there are some churches I would wonder if anyone was. You see, because you'll read the statistics and they'll say there's 1.4 billion Christians on earth. Is that what you think? 1.4 billion? That's a lot, right? I mean, you see, how do you know? Let me ask it this way. I'll get an application out of this. Have you ever wondered about somebody you know? And you're talking to your husband and say, do you think they're saved? Oh, I don't know. Maybe, yeah, could be. Maybe. I'm not sure. Why aren't you sure? Wheat and tares are hard. You see, wheat and tares are hard to separate, aren't they? And so we invent all kinds of things. I mean, it's almost shameful what we do. And I've said this, and I mean it sincerely, but it sounds facetious. I get that. But I am amazed that Jesus said, broad is the way that leads to destruction, narrow is the gate that leads to life. But almost every person that's ever attended this church believes everybody they love and know are all part of the narrow gate. Every person they know, every uncle, aunt, cousin, brother, everybody that they've ever known are all going through the narrow gate. All the rest of the world may be taking the broad way, but not anyone they know. It's amazing. Well, where do they go? Well, they don't go to church. They don't want anything to do with it. But I know. You see, why? Because I want to know. I want that to be the case. Who wouldn't want that to be the case? But does that make me wanting it make it true? You see, broad and narrow, those aren't my words. Those are Jesus' words. And remember, he didn't talk about it in light of the world. He was talking broad and narrow in that little country called Israel. That's what he was saying. Most of the people in Israel are not saved. I mean, think of that. And by the way, how many were saved? You got a couple million people there, a little bit more maybe by now. And so when the church was born, give me the numbers you know. We had 5,000, right? Out of 2 million, that's almost everybody, isn't it? It's not, is it? See, it's never been like that. It never will be like that. It's the wheat and tares. So notice as he goes on and tries to explain that. He said, and the slaves of the landowner came and said to him, sir, we did not, he said, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares? And he said, an enemy has done this. And the slaves said, do you want us then to go and gather them up? We'll get them. He said, no. I love it. Lest while you're gathering the tares, you root out the wheat with them. Allow both to grow together until the harvest. And in, he said, the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather up the tares and bind them in bundles. And he said, and to burn them up and gather the wheat into my barn. The tares you bind into bundles and burn them up and you gather the wheat in. When? At the harvest. You know, that's kind of interesting. And it, applicationally, it even works. I mean, I know people that if this is their testimony. They don't say it this way. I'd been coming to the church for 15 years, and the first 14 years I was a tare and didn't know it. But I just came to Christ. Now I'm wheat. Give the Lord time. He said, that's always going to be the case. Satan always imitates what Christ does. That's why there's an antichrist in the book of Revelation. You see, he always imitates it. So will he sow tares where God sows wheat? Yes. Always. You see, that's the point. That's why Paul talks about it all the time. What's the church need to be? Discerning. Why does the church need to be discerning? Paul says, because there are false prophets everywhere. They're there. And you're never going to say, not us. We don't have anybody like that. He said, no, they're everywhere. That's the way it works. So he says, this all be decided at, he says, the harvest, which makes a very, very good sense from almost any possible way of looking at it. Now notice then, at verse 34, we'll skip a few here, and we'll come back to the mustard seed in 11. He says, all these things Jesus spoke to the multitudes in parables. He did not speak to them without a parable, so that, he said, what was spoken of through the prophet might be fulfilled. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the foundation of the world. They're designed to be difficult. He said, then he left the multitudes, went into the house. His disciples came to him and said, explain to us the parable of the tares in the field. I just love them. We just did the sower. Can you explain that? Now, could you explain this one? And he answered, and he said, the one who sows good seeds, the Son of Man, that's me. And the field is the world. And as for the good seed, he said, these are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the son of the evil one. He said, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil, and the harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, just as the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send forth his angels. They will gather out of his kingdom all the stumbling blocks and those who commit lawlessness, cast them into a furnace of fire. And that always means just judgment. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then the righteous will shine forth like the sun, the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. And see, what he's teaching them there is, he's applying the principle, if you're not for me, you're against me. Like a lot of times when it comes to Jesus, people want to be neutral. Well, I don't believe what you people believe about. I think he's a really good guy. I mean, you see how this works. He goes, no, you're not for me, you're against me. There's only two kinds of people in this world, wheat and tares. That's it. Okay, you can't be one. Can't be in both. You can be one of them. But that's always decided at the time of the harvest. Now let's go to verse 31 then, back to the mustard seed. He presented another parable and said, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in a field. Notice what he's using. Every single one of these, every single one of these is about farming. Because that's what the people understood. He's just taking a very common imagery. He said, and this is smaller than all other seeds, but when it is full grown, it is larger than garden plants and has become a tree, so that the birds of the air can come and nest in its branches. Okay, now this is another one that gets all bent out of shape for some folks. All right. You'll hear a lot of people say, well, that proves that Jesus couldn't have said that because that's a lie. It's not the smallest seed in the world. Okay? But one of the reasons for it is they haven't really investigated the mustard seed in that sense. If you took a mustard seed and put it in your palm, it's got like a little shell in it, and you rub it out in your palm to crush it all. Inside that mustard seed, just infinitesimally so, is a little black dot. That black dot's the mustard seed. What we call the mustard seed is the shell around the little black dot. The seed is that tiny, which would make it very tiny. But there's another explanation that's even more common than that. It's a Hebrew idiom. The Jews of Jesus' day said, the smallest thing in the world is a mustard seed. So, when they wanted to measure length, how many mustard seeds? You see, because that's the smallest increment we have. We could call it a millimeter or what. And if you wanted to measure weight, it's a mustard seed. How many mustard seeds would that weigh? So it's a Hebrew idiom, and Jesus could have been just using it as an idiom. He wasn't trying to give a biology lesson here. It's a parable, you see, consequently from that. But notice what he says. And I can remember this. He said, it is larger than garden plants. A single mustard seed in one single season can grow to a tree of 32 feet. That's pretty fast. I kind of wish, by the way, right out here, if you ever look, there's a little twig out there. That's not a mustard seed. That's a red maple. That's about 3-4 years old. If it's grown a quarter of an inch, I can't see it in 4 years. It's alive, but it doesn't grow at all. A mustard seed had been up there in 1 year. What's he saying? All he's saying is this. The church is going to start really small. Really small. But in no time, it's going to grow really big. So big that birds can nest in it. You see, that's what he's saying. You're going from a nesting tree, from a tiny little thing. He's telling the disciples, this is going to grow like you won't believe when it starts. And that's exactly what happened. And still happens today. I mean, the church is everywhere in the world. Just growing. You see, and it started out as a mustard seed. 11 guys. His disciples. You see, it's amazing, and that's all Jesus wants to say here. It's going to start small, and it's going to get big. Notice the next one. And he spoke another parable to them and said, the kingdom of heaven is like leaven. He said, which a woman took and hid in 3 pecks of meal until it was all leaven. Okay. So this is about leaven. Now, please, I've had this redundantly done in the past. I'm not going to accept that tonight. I won't talk to you in the lobby about it. So many Christians say, leaven always means something evil. Not here. This is not about evil. There is leaven. That's why you have unleavened bread, okay? And it can represent sin. That's not here. He is talking about how pervasive the church is going to be. He's going to talk of, just like with the mustard seed, the growth and how pervasive. It's going to encompass everything. See, that's how leaven works. You know, this story, I can remember Dr. Pentecost told this story, and it no reason, he was a wonderful teacher at the seminary. But if you want to keep the next bread rising, do you have to add new leaven? Where do you get your old leaven from? I know you ladies aren't bakers. The bread you made the day before, right? Right? Yeah, that's how you do it. Dr. Pentecost said that when he was a young student just graduating from Dallas, he was pastoring or doing temporal pastor work in a rural small town in Texas. And he went to the house of the man a man who was an elderly man in his 70s. And he said, they had homemade bread. And Dr. Pentecost, I said, that bread's outstanding. That is really good. And he said, the man said to him, you have to know the story of this. When I was a little boy, we moved here from Tennessee. And the leaven that my mother brought is the leaven in that bread. All those decades later, every time we made bread, we just added, that just kept pervasive. Notice, it just keeps going and going and going and going. And that's what Jesus is saying. He said, that's the way the kingdom of heaven will be. It'll be like leaven. It'll permeate virtually everything. That's the way yeast works. It's a irreversible product. It's persistent, pervasive, and irreversible. Now, he moves on then, after that, and he goes to the hidden treasure in verse 44. He says there, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid. And he said, from joy over it, he said, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Now, there are, I'll give you some of them, but there are a lot of interpretations of this, but one's pretty obvious and simple. Now, understand something here. I'll give you what's written in the Talmud by the Jews. The Jewish rabbis in the Talmud said this: there is only one safe place to put your money in the earth. That's the only place you'd be safe. So when you had conquering armies and things like that, you see, you put your money in the earth. You bury it on your property. Now, it's kind of an interesting thought. So then you still have some issues here, some ethical ones. It says the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that was hidden in a field, which a man found, and then he hid it again. Okay? And from joy over it, he goes and he sells all that he has and he buys the field. And you'd say, wait a minute, does that sound ethical to you? It would if you were Jewish, especially at the time of Christ. I'll simplify something what the rabbis taught. Rabbinic teaching at the time of Christ. You may have heard this phrase. Finders keepers, losers weepers. If you found it, it's yours. You see how this works. By the way, you don't want to overthink this. It's a parable. It's not a real story. But what was in that treasure could have been from two or three generations before. It might not have been the person who owned the field at all. You see, it could have been hidden by ancestors. And someone found it. Now, on the surface, what do you think Jesus is saying here? Make money any way you can, right? That sounds just like Jesus. It's not what he's saying, is it? What is he saying? The kingdom of heaven is worth everything you have. The kingdom of heaven is worth everything you have. He sold everything he had for the treasure. See, that's the point. He sold everything he had to buy this. That makes some sense. You see, from that point, it's a very simple way of looking at it. Secondly, we run into the pearl of great price. Again, he says, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and he sold all that he had and he bought it. Interesting. By the way, in Israel at the time, there were pearls in the Mediterranean, but they didn't have much value. But there were pearls in the Persian Gulf and in both all the way to the other side of Spain or all the way into the Indian Ocean that had great value. So he's not talking about a Mediterranean pearl. He said a merchant, he said, now notice again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. Now, the guy I just said about the treasure, was he looking for anything? He just said looking out the land. He might have just wondered what the soil was like and heard, dum, dum, dum. Hey, what's that? Digs it out. Hey, look, I got a box here. There's a whole bunch of stuff in it. You see what I mean? This guy, he looks for pearls as a profession. He's looking all the time. And he finally finds the pearl of great price. You see, he finds that pearl. So as soon as he finds that pearl, he sold everything he had to buy it. Why? From his point of view, from him, the value of the pearl. The pearl had so much value, he said, it's worth every single thing I have. See, what is Jesus teaching here? That's what the kingdom of heaven is like. It's worth everything you have. You see, it's pervasive. It's going to go everywhere. Most people, when it comes to the kingdom of heaven, will reject it. But some will find it. And they'll produce fruit up to 100-fold, 30-fold, 60-fold. You see, each one of these relate together. He's trying to teach his disciples, if Israel has rejected the messianic kingdom of Jesus Christ, then what is the state of the kingdom of heaven? Jesus said, this is the state of the kingdom of heaven. You see, he's trying to teach him its incredible value, its enormous growth, and its disappointing acceptance by people. And that hasn't changed since the time of Christ. All those things are just as important now as they were when Jesus uttered those words, every single one of them. The next one is the dragnet. Again, he said, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet cast into the sea, gathering fish of every kind. A dragnet, normally if you're going to fish in Israel, Sea of Galilee, you get two boats and you put a net between them. Then you move the boats through sailing in a direction until your net's full. Then you pull the net up and then you have, what do you have in a net? Everything. Fish you'd want to eat, fish that could sell, fish you don't want to eat. You see, you'd have everything got caught in the net. Some of it's good and a lot of it's not. You're just fishing. Notice he says here, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet into the sea, gathering fish of every kind. And when it is filled, they drew it up on the beach and they sat down and they gathered the good fish into containers. And he says, but the bad, they threw it away. This sounds an awful like what we're just talking about, the wheat and its tares. See, it's virtually the same idea again. He said, so it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth, take out the wicked from among the righteous, and will cast them into the furnace of fire, judgment, that there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So he's very clear again. But one thing that's becoming hopefully clear to you, in the end, who decides who's in and who's out? God does. And he sends his angels to administer that. Notice who he didn't say decides. You and me. He didn't say you decide. God says, I'll decide this. It'll be perfect justice. We won't miss anyone. You see, if you're a good fish, you're in good shape. You see, if you're wheat, you're in great shape. That's what he's trying to say. That will be something that's done, he says, at the end, he said, of the age. And if you think about it from the nation Israel's point of view, I find it kind of interesting. If you view this at the end of Israel, the beginning of the millennial kingdom, what's fascinating to me is this. How many people will enter the millennial kingdom, enter it, unsaved? Zero. There'll be no unsaved person on earth who enters the millennial kingdom, only the saved. Now, by the way, by the end of 1,000 years, how many unsaved people are there? Like the sands of the seashore. And they grow exponentially because they hate Jesus and they hate justice. But he says that'll be done at the end of the age. And there's a lot of truth to that. Then 51, he says, have you understood all these things? Here it is. And they said, yeah, we got it. I love that. I hope that's true. But by then they got to think, I could almost hear it when he did something like, you know, when he does something like the treasure, or the, you know, you can almost hear one guy, the other, don't ask. We're not asking. He's telling us he's going to talk this way, so we're the only ones who understand, but I don't know what we understand or what we don't understand. So he asked him right up, do you understand? He said, yeah, we got it. So it's interesting. Hope it's true. So he says, Yes. And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has become a disciple in the kingdom of heaven is like a head of household who brings forth out of his treasure things new and old. This one's a little bit more complicated. He's talking about a particular group of people, isn't he? Who's he talking about? Scribes. Scribes. What does a scribe do? If you don't know the answer, just say he scribes. Then you got it. Yeah, he's a copier. Scribes devote their whole life to recopying the entire Old Testament. And by the way, that's one of the things that's so unusual. When a Jewish scribe copies the Old Testament, I've told you this in the past, there are so many things that have to be done. For example, if Yahweh, that word, shows up, he has to cleanse himself completely before he can write the word. Has a new pen or quill doing it, and has to cleanse himself after he's written the word. Now, there are places in the Old Testament where the word shows up a lot. So that'd be a very clean couple days for him, just trying to write that word on. But they're that careful. They have all kinds of measures and countermeasures, all kinds of counting techniques, exact letters they have, all kinds of stuff just like that. When the copy is finished, they burn the thing they copied. There's no other copies. They burn it. That's what they do. Now, they've done this, you see, for a long, long period of time. That's what they do. And they obviously would know the Old Testament. They're writing it word for word. Now, through the 1940s, the oldest copy of the Old Testament that we found that existed on earth was AD 800. 800 years after Christ. That's the oldest copy of the Old Testament that was found on earth. And then a Bedouin boy, you know, threw a stone in a cave and heard a pot break. And they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were dated 200 years BC. In other words, the Dead Sea Scrolls were 1,000 years older than the oldest copy we had ever seen. And so they were able to compare it. And it was amazing how exacting they were in copying these documents for that long a period of time. But Jesus is assuming here that a scribe knows the Old Testament. He does. He knows the Old Testament. Now, Pharisees, they knew the Old Testament. They memorized it. But a scribe works with it every day. Now, notice what he says again. He said, therefore, every scribe who has become a disciple of the kingdom of heaven, this is a believer now, is like the head of a household who brings forth out of his treasure things new and old. Remember the last study I did a study on all the types of Christ in the Old Testament? All these things that are a type of Christ, so many, it's just endless. Tabernacle Christ, the festivals Christ, he's everywhere. Melchizedek Christ. That's Old Testament truth. A scribe knows that. He knows it. See, what he is saying is, if you're a scribe and you really know the Old Testament, when you come to me, you have knowledge of that's old and knowledge that's new, and you can marry them both together just like we do. If you're a scribe, you can do that. Jesus wanted to be careful that we never would think that now that there's a New Testament, we can disregard the Old Testament completely. We can't. Because the writer of Hebrews tells us the Old Testament is God's shadow of the substance of Christ who is to come. So is the Old Testament true? Is it complete? No. Christ completes the Old Testament in the New Testament. The New Testament, and it is called progressive revelation of God. You see, consequently, that's the way it works. But Jesus is trying to say, but don't divorce one from the other. You see, the program is changing. But don't divorce it from the Old Testament. That's why he brings the scribe in at this particular time. So those are the parables that he uses in Matthew. Now, what I find kind of amazing in this is that if you look down to 53 then, it says, and it came about that when Jesus finished these parables, he departed from there. And coming to his hometown, he began teaching them in the synagogue, so that they became astonished and said, where did this man get this wisdom, these miraculous powers? Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not Mary his mother and his brothers, James and Joseph and Simon and Judas and his sisters? Are they not all with us? Where did this man get these things? And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown, in his own household. And he did not, he said, do many miracles because of their unbelief. By the way, you know from John, they wanted to stone him to death. What happens right now? The persecution really amps up. Once Jesus explains what's happening from here on in, from Matthew 13, 53, all the way through Matthew 16, 12. He's the attacks from Herod on John. You have the attacks of the scribes and the Pharisees. You have on chapter 16, the attack of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This is when all the attacks start, full bore, this last year of his ministry. But Jesus set it all up because now you understand why he was speaking in parables. Now his enemies are out to get him, and they're going to try to get him. And ultimately, from their point of view, they do get him, they think. But all they're doing is fulfilling exactly what he said, I came to earth to do anyway. But that's the way this works. So that's the first part of the parables. These parables are strategic in the ministry of Jesus Christ. Could we close in prayer, please? Father, I'm praying as we build on these in the weeks to come that we become more and more familiar with parabolic teaching and why Jesus uses it and how he uses it. It's an amazing thing. He takes the most common things in life and turns them into spiritually profound lessons. Father, I pray that as we understand the parables better, we understand our Lord better and fall deeper and deeper in love with him. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.